You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group. www.americantheater.org.
Welcome to Offscript, American Theater's podcast on all things theatrical. I'm the editor-in-chief, Rob Weinert-Kent, and I'm here with...
Deep Tran, associate editor.
And our guest today is Joshua Dax from Fisher Dax Associates. He's here to talk a little bit about our usual slate of topics, but also he has the key story in our July-August issue on theater architecture, and we're going to talk a little bit about that as well as other things. Josh, welcome.
Thank you. Hi.
We were away in Portland a couple weekends ago, right before the Julius Caesar thing broke, and then this past... We're recording this while we're in the midst of reporting on the Hedy Weiss controversy in Chicago, so we'll touch on those issues with the asterisk that by the time this podcast comes out, things may have changed, and we will probably have a story, or at least one story, about that controversy that Deep's reporting.
We have the op-ed, too.
We have at least two pieces coming out. And as well, the theater architecture issue will be online by the time this comes out. We also will have an interview I did a few weeks ago with Allison Friedman of Ping Pong Productions, who brings Western plays to China and also brings Chinese plays and Chinese theater artists to the U.S., and she has an interesting story about touring A.I. Doctor's Disgraced around China. And it was just it didn't make it into our China Chinese theater issue in May, June. The schedule didn't work out, but I thought it was a fascinating story. I'm glad that we got to hear directly from Allison about. So it's a very full episode. We could start off with Julius Caesar. It's a couple weeks old now, the controversy, but I wonder if we could talk about what the takeaways from this. We just heard reports today, I guess, that Oscar Eustedson's wife received death threats.
Yes. Should we summarize it?
Yeah. And we heard also the stories over the weekend that Shakespeare theaters around the country receiving threats. I mean, you could summarize the controversy as quickly as possible.
Yes. Okay. So Shakespeare in the Park, of the Public Theater's free production of Shakespeare that they do every year in Central Park. The first production of the summer season is Julius Caesar, directed by Public Theater Artistic Director Oscar Eustace. And it attracted some controversy because it portrayed Julius Caesar as a Trump-like figure with the Slavic-accented wife and being stabbed by senators in business suits. So Breitbart got word that they were, quote unquote, stabbing Trump on stage,
right,
which led to
someone got a video of it. I think
someone took a video of it too,
fired it up,
which led to report on Fox and Friends, which led to death threats and angry phone calls to the Public Theater, which led to Delta Airlines pulling its funding from the Public Theater and also Bank of America pulling its name from the marquee of sponsors of the Public Theater's Shakespeare in the Park.
Right. And I think the NEA distanced itself. There were two protests during performances of the show
People rushed the stage.
Yeah, at least one of them was planned, and the person was going to profit off of that. So the public handled it with aplomb.
Created a hashtag.
Right.
Themselves.
I mean, one lesson is that apart from the argument about the production itself, the way the public handled this, I think, was a good way to handle it. Oscar Eustace was out front, and they responded. Well, the stage managers were heroic kept the show running.
Yeah, well, Oscar basically said, I'm summarizing, there's a video of this online that we can post, saying that, free speech and expression and art belongs to everyone and we stand by our production. Mm-hmm. And Delta Airlines and Bank of America, we appreciate them as sponsors. They have the right to do this.
Right.
So, but more to the point, he emphasized the point that the Public Theater was not advocating or supporting violence in the political arena, but in fact that the play is a strong argument against it, and that if you stay for any scene beyond the stabbing, right, which apparently Breitbart didn't do,
right,
you find that the conspirators all get killed and democracy vanishes from the face of the earth for 2,000 years.
Right.
So it doesn't really turn out well.
No.
Well, Josh and Rob, I didn't see the production, but the two of you did. And isn't it true that the conspirators, like, they're wearing pussy hats and they're mostly people of color and they all die in the end of the show, basically?
Well, there is a large crowd scene in which some people are wearing pussy hats.
I think at one point Cassius, John Tuzes Thompson, walks in a pussy hat. This is early on in the play. And there's the "This is what democracy looks like" chant. This is early on. There's no attempt to shy away from those associations, I would say. And there is that, and that at the end, and I think this might be a problem for the production in the way that it lands at the end. The police state forces, the riot gear of the Mark Antony Empire, opposing the sort of like street protesters who are pretty much all shot at the end. I mean, I'm not arguing with the resonance of it. I wonder about
whether or not
how that lands. I mean, I feel like
Julius Caesar.
We saw it, Josh. I feel like indeed the play does not advocate violence. I think by putting that the sort of stunt of the assassination being looking like Trump, a little bit like Trump or a Trump-like figure, it really puts the energy on that scene in a way that really doesn't drain the rest of the play of energy. But it, even though you do stay for the rest of it, and the point is definitely comes across. I don't know. I think I would say if he intended to provoke, it was provocative. Did you feel that at all when you were watching it?
Yeah, you know, you have to defend an artist's right to do whatever they want to do. It's interesting because I saw Shauna Cooper's production at OSF.
Okay, you know, yeah,
a week later, I think.
What did Julius Caesar look like in that production?
What you normally see,
right? Right.
Togas,
there are some wonderful, wonderful things about that production, and some really original things that I had never seen anybody do before that were terrific. It's inevitable with that play that it brings to mind whatever contemporary events there are,
right?
And it's such a lightning rod for you know, contemporary political thinking that you know, you almost ask yourself, do you have to say anything in order to get people to think along those lines?
That's a good argument. I feel like that play is always played differently in the U.S. where, because Shakespeare didn't write it in a democracy or republic, he wrote it. What's eerie about it to me is that how many call-outs, and this is true of every production done in the U.S. the line about this, that will be good enough for the Senate. which this character says, you know, Shakespeare didn't have a Senate. He wrote this play in English about the Roman Republic. And then not too long after the assassination, there's that meta-theatrical moment where they wash their hands in blood. And I think Cassius says, how many times will this scene be played out in countries yet unborn? Yeah. It's like, that always gives me chills. And this one in particular is like, as if Shakespeare knew, was like a prophet or something, of that this would one day play in a republic in which these issues. So it's true that those issues always come up with American productions of this play, whether you make an explicit reference to a current administration or past administration. There was a pantsuit sort of Hillary at, was it Shakespeare and Company? Shakespeare.
I don't remember, but there was
Tina Packer's Theater, I think, did one a couple years ago that didn't get into controversy. That
right,
was,
and the Guthrie Obama style,
yeah, exactly.
Julius Caesar.
Yeah.
I think what's been frightening about this for me was the fact that, apropos of any facts and context about the play itself, it seemed like there was this virulent anger from the right at anything that could be construed as critiquing this current administration and the need, almost violently because of all of these death threats, to shutting it all down. Right. And these big corporations being so worried about like potentially losing the business of those, you know, violent people that they were willing to like distance themselves from this production. And the NEA was thinking the same thing. And so you just think, especially the news today, this past week, about the White House like not allowing reporters to record the White House press briefings, you just think, like, how close are we to being censored and not being allowed to critique the government? And, like, what are the repercussions of that? And bigger question is, like, how do artists function in this kind of environment when they don't have, like, the purview of the public theater and all of the commercial money that theater brings in?
Right. I mean, yeah, I would say we're not close, but it's something to keep an eye on, especially because, as you say, the public was able to replace that money, and they have a very high profile. I don't know if every theater in much redder states that's getting random phone calls from Yahoos with death threats because the word Shakespeare's in their title. You know, we'll also watch this story at American Theater as something that maybe it will dissipate. Maybe people can be educated. Maybe this is just a small fringe. I don't know. I hope so. I mean, obviously, the White House is not a small fringe. So it's something to be vigilant about.
There's just so many crazy people.
There's enough crazy people to cause damage, I guess. So I don't know if there's a good segue into the Hedy Weiss controversy. Hedy Weiss is the Chicago Sun-Times critic, theater critic since the early 80s, I believe. And she's had a long career of controversy about her work, along different lines of critique. But recently, she reviewed a Steppenwolf show called Pass Over, which is sort of a reimagined Waiting for Godot with
two young black men,
and I believe the Pazzo and Lucky. It's plays out along racial lines, mm-hmm. and police brutality is part of it, part of the theme. And Hedy wrote a review. I mean, you could look it up online if you're not familiar with this at all, that seemed to invoke the canard about, well, what about black-on-black crime? And this seems like this play, she was praising the play basically, but quibbling with its depiction of white police and brutality. And, you know, has a history of bringing the sort of politics like that into her reviews. As a response, Steppenwolf issued a statement. And an alliance formed, Chicago Theaters Accountability.
Yeah, it's called the Chicago Theater Accountability Coalition.
Right.
And they released a petition.
The headline of which said, "Stop inviting Hedy Weiss to your shows." And I think the official policy is to ask theaters to sign on to deny her comps, make her pay for her tickets. I think there's some disagreement. We should asterisk all this. We're going to Deep's reporting the piece. And she's speaking to a lot of people in the community. Without scooping ourselves,
we can't scoop ourselves if this
will be out after the piece is out. I mean, I guess the feeling is pretty strong.
Mm-hmm. So far, the petition's gotten 3,500 signatures. Mm-hmm. At the time of recording, it's been a week and a half. Mm-hmm. So that's a good amount of people. And this really, from what I talked to two members of that's been leading the coalition. And from what they told me, this has been bubbling up for a long time because Hedy Weiss does have a history of saying some very problematic things in her theater reviews. For instance, in a review of A Silk Invasion at Silk Rose,
right.
Rose, Silk Road Silk Rising. Rising. Silk Road. Wow, so yeah. Many R's.
Yeah.
When the play is about racially profiling of Muslims and how wrong that is. And she basically said, well, you know, considering the Boston Marathon, maybe racially profiling brown people is a good idea.
Right, right. And so there was a weird controversy like where that. The Sun-Times
took out that line.
Edited that line, and that was also controversial in itself, just the editing of that.
So what the coalition told me was this question of, like, does the theater want to condone bigotry? And by giving her free comps, are they doing that? And also, it's a community that's trying to diversify itself and making it safer for artists of color to work there. And so, like, having a theater critic who says problematic things without consequence is to them an issue, especially because Hedy Weiss has not responded to any of the criticisms of her reviews.
Yeah, she doesn't engage with it.
Yeah, she doesn't engage. Generally. And then I talk with Chris Jones about it, where he defended her on the grounds of free speech and said a lot of people in America believe that black-on-black crime is the reason for police brutality. And so we need to reckon with that. And perhaps, like, her viewpoint is one way that we do that.
Well, she speaks for certain audience members, certainly.
Yeah, certain
not all of them. Chris Jones, the critic at the Tribune.
At the Tribune.
Yeah.
And the Tribune itself issued a statement saying about theater artists wanting safe space, and that's ridiculous.
Right,
and,
right.
Yeah.
Well, we'll report on all this. I think the ball to watch is which theaters are signing on and to what degree to this petition. The Goodman issued a statement, which I think was right down the middle in a way I thought was pretty mature and responsible about acknowledging the pain that Hetty's words and I think they generalize it to criticism in general that can cause, and taking bias seriously, but also saying we're as a large institution, we're not going to ban critics from coming to see our work. I mean, there's a lot of discussion about whether it's a ban or not, because just to single her out to make her pay for the tickets or make the Sun-Times pay for the tickets it's not technically a ban. She could certainly do that.
She can come if she wants to. She just has to pay for tickets.
But it is singling her out for a different practice than other critics. I mean, again, as they would say, for good reason.
Josh, you look like you had something you wanted to say.
Yeah, well, it's kind of a slippery slope. I mean, moments ago you were talking about being worried about the censorship of free speech,
yeah, totally,
by the current administration. And, you know, there is that old canard that is actually true. The only appropriate response to, you know,
bad speech is
good speech.
Right.
And censorship is worrisome however it crops up.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was actually talking to Robert Schenken about this in Portland, that there was a time when a lot of American film and theater, you know, I was talking about Watch on the Rhine, which mm-hmm. is suddenly being revived.
Lillian Hellman, yeah.
Which is about the importance of sort of standing up for what used to be called American values, you know, truth, justice in the American way, and
right.
free speech, and defending the weak, and
yeah.
all of those kinds of things, and defending your right to say something even if you disagree.
Right, right.
And we've sort of lost that and gone into our corners, and that's led to a very confrontational sort of attitude. And it's easy to sort of get entrenched in that. And, mm-hmm. and you know, Robert's play, Building the Wall,
right.
Begins to remind us, you know, that there is a sense of personal responsibility that you have to have as an American. And it means speaking out when you see things go wrong, and taking responsibility to yourself to sort of do something about it.
Right.
And I don't know. I just, the answer to censorship is not more censorship,
yeah.
I guess, is my feeling.
What I've been struggling with is been thinking about what to do if you're someone who wants to speak out against what you think is the wrong the critic is doing, or the institution of, because there isn't an equal playing field for those voices to speak back. And this is a question that
she ignores them when they do.
With in criticism in general. Should there be more dialogue back and forth? Should the critic just make their pronouncement and go into their show? Or should they be on social media? Should they be talking to people? Should they be having dialogues, going to forums? I tend toward the thinking that the latter way is the way we should be going. It makes us, ideally makes us better at our jobs.
It just seems to me, and this is me speaking for myself, I'm not going to put opinions in the article that I write, but it seems to me, it kind of goes back to that debate everyone was having a couple months ago when Richard Spencer, the white supremacist, got punched, and a lot of people were then debating, should you punch a Nazi? And do you fight back against people threatening genocide with more violence? And I think the thing is, that's also why people were so angry when the New York Times hired that climate change denier columnist, because you're placing hate speech on an equal playing field with speech for tolerance, and that's not an equal playing field.
Well, but we're talking about speech. I don't want to get into the punching Nazis
I don't think you should punch people. But the thing is, like, do you restrict white supremacists, or do you allow them to spew their hateful comments without consequence?
It depends what the consequence is. I think that's what the consequence is, that you push, that they get pushback, and that they are barred from certain places to speak. But they shouldn't be stopped from speaking, literally, like by punching them, right?
Well, I mean, that's what I would say.
You know, again, we don't have to give. They're not owed a forum. They're not owed a platform. They can create whatever platform they want. But they should be pushed back against vigorously. I think that's where I'm wondering what to do with the pushback against a critic you find abhorrent. And if it's a whole community that's really felt this viscerally, you can really feel that among the Chicago community. As with all critical pylons, there's a lot of people coming, joining the fight, who have real specific other problems with Hetty, which I, you know, that's always a problem with a critic. They don't have a lot of friends when they're down.
And there's fewer and fewer of them.
Yeah, that's also true. I think there's some defensiveness on the part of critics, including, you know, I don't want to characterize the defensiveness in a bad way. It's just we feel besieged, you know, a little bit. And sometimes for good reason.
Right. Well, there is a lot of pain in that community too, especially when it comes to like police brutality,
right,
and Hetty's review coming out the same week that the murderer of Philando Castile was not convicted.
Right.
And so there's a sense of like that whole canard of saying, you know, what about black on black crime? It obscures a very real fact that black men are still continuing to die at the hands of police officers without consequence.
Right.
And those police officers not suffering consequence. So there's that too, and the inability of her paper and of the Sun Times, of Hetty and the Sun Times and the Tribune to acknowledge that is a problem.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think, I haven't looked at their coverage elsewhere of that though. I mean, we can't characterize all their coverage as being myopic on that front, right? I mean, it's a very divisive issue there. That's why I've been hesitant to have come out too strongly either way on either Hetty or on the issues of this, of crime in Chicago. It's really a thorny one, right? I mean, Chris acknowledged that in his mostly laudatory review as well, you know. But asking this play in that reflexive way, like, oh, I'm watching white racism and brutality depicted, what about this other thing, is ridiculous. I mean, you can't ask this play. That's not what the play is about, right? So I would agree with
right,
that.
Right.
Yeah. Anyway, we did talk about that a lot. I think there's no segue to it, but theater architecture. Let's talk about that. Something
topic.
I guess lighter. Although I would argue your piece, Josh, is not light at all. It goes back to the roots of sort of Western theater, and talks about this, what you would call like a cycle of why don't you say it's innovation. I don't have it in front of me.
Yeah,
say
you know, as you look back at history, you find, I think, that, well, first of all, let me back up a minute.
Yeah,
there's a wonderful writer named David Wiles. I don't know if you know his books, but
no.
he's written a lot about a variety of things, Greek tragedy and other things. But he talks about, and others have too, how theater is primarily a spatial practice.
Right.
Right. I mean, it's organizing action, for lack of a better term, in space in order to create meaning or feeling. And, so the decision about where you do that and what the place brings to the table is an important one. And if you look back at what the Greeks were doing, doing performances in places that had special cultural significance to their community because, you know, it was next to a particular altar or on a sacred site or with a view of whatever it was.
Right.
They were organizing their performances to take advantage of the special meaning of the place.
Okay.
And they didn't begin by building what we think of as a Greek amphitheater. They just sort of improvised a performance in a place that already had cultural meaning. And, you know, having done that improvisation and refined it, they mm-hmm. eventually did literally set it in stone.
Yeah.
and it became a typology, right? So instead of an improvisation, just sort of ad hoc in a place, it became a thing that you then repeat. And it did get repeated all across the Hellenistic world.
And institutionalized, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it became no longer an improvisation, but a formal typology that you knew how to repeat, and you repeated it, and people that were creating the work were writing for it and staging for it and, you know, enriching it, presumably. And then, you know, their civilization disappeared, but then the Romans came along.
Right, right.
And they didn't need hillsides anymore. They could build their own hillside because they were really good engineers. And these things could pop up wherever they wanted. And so they manufactured places of cultural significance throughout their empire, in a sense, imitating a Greek imitation of a found space.
Of a found space, right, right.
So you sort of, you know, as I thought about that, I realized that this happens time and time again.
Right,
and,
right.
And, you know, in the Elizabethan period, people started on trestles in market courtyards and refined that model, eventually decided to build a theater in Shoreditch in 1576. That became a typology that was repeated
right.
In the Elizabethan period about 11 times. Again, in Italy, this happened, and it turned into the proscenium theater. And
right.
Then, we sort of improvise something and then repeat it and repeat it and repeat it.
And then there's also the impulse to say, this is too stultifying. We need to get out of this, get outdoors, get into it, found another found space,
exactly.
Right? Finding
so
a new space.
So, with the continuity that we've had since the Renaissance,
right.
we feel less continuity with the Romans and with the Greeks,
right.
But
okay.
We feel continuity in a sense with the Elizabethans. And with that continuity, we've seen people get tired of things, right? Whether it's Tyrone Guthrie deciding he's going to experiment with a thrust form or,
right.
or others experimenting with arenas and studio theaters and things. People have tried things. And now, of course, a lot of those experiments are themselves typologies that get repeated again and again and again. There isn't a university in the English speaking world that doesn't have a studio theater somewhere in its
right.
theater department
right.
and probably a thrust and certainly a proscenium. So these things get institutionalized over time. And now, once again, we find artists that are sort of reacting against that and seeking the next thing. They're improvising found spaces.
Mm-hmm.
They're improvising in found spaces. But interestingly, some of those approaches in found spaces are themselves becoming institutionalized.
Yeah.
Which is interesting and not surprising, and in some cases a little ironic.
Well, I loved about your article because I'm a big site-specific theater glutton. And so what I loved was like people are coming to you now saying, hey, I saw Sleep No More and I really loved it. Can you like make me a space like that?
Make yeah. you a found space, a creative yeah. found space. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, this was a developer in China, actually, unsurprisingly. They wanted to sort of build a place for this. And
right.
I tried to explain to them how futile that idea is. What are you going to build a warehouse and invite people to create for it?
Like an air-conditioned
right.
warehouse
yeah.
with like
yeah,
maybe
exactly.
some cushioning.
Yeah, right. Yeah. You've got, they actually have plenty of disused factories that are really terrific and being turned into art galleries.
Okay.
And,
yeah. Yeah.
And things like that. So you could just go find one. You don't actually have to build one.
Now, and Fisher Dax is involved with, in consulting on The Shed, right?
Yeah.
And Fisher Dax Associates, where you're a partner. Right,
yep.
We were figuring
yep.
out what your title is there, partner. Yep. And The Shed is a version of that, isn't it? It's a version of sort of a flexible found space, but made as an institutionalized space. I don't want to overcharacterize.
Yeah, no,
you
that's exactly
it. Yeah.
Right. We're a theater planning and design firm, so we do all kinds of performance spaces. We've been associated with the Armory for a long time,
right.
Helping adapt it for performance, and also helping mount a lot of the productions they're designing. Designing the productions or designing the seating for the productions. And as that model, which is related to the Ruhr Triennial Festival in Bochum, Germany, and other spaces in Essen, which are huge industrial spaces where productions like Die Soldaten came from,
okay.
and Die Materie that had the flock of sheep wandering around.
Okay.
These amazing productions that could only happen in these vast spaces.
Mm-hmm.
It's clear there's an appetite for that kind of thing. And quite some time ago now, probably 6 years ago or more, Liz Diller and David Rockwell, two wonderful architects, pitched the idea of a kind of large-scale Kunsthalle, which in their minds, I think, at the time was more targeted for visual art than it was for performance. And since then, there's been a shift. And in fact, the artistic director who had formerly been at the Armory is now at the Shed, and it's really moving very much in that direction.
Hmm.
But the idea of the Shed is that there's nominally four floors of spaces that can be used as galleries and or for performance and other kinds of indoor things, and then there's a huge roof system that rolls on railroad tracks. That's poised over it, sort of like a there's no sort of like a, I mean, I guess you could call it kind of a tea cozy, but it rolls away.
Wow.
So it covers the building most of the time, and then it can roll out on these railroad tracks to cover a large piece of what is normally outdoor plaza. And there are deployable draperies and other kinds of systems, so it can be darkened and enclosed or left open, and light can come in. And
that sounds like a really fun rooftop bar.
Well, yeah, there is that too.
So now that this is in downtown New York, and it's going to open when?
Well, it's in the Hudson
West.
Yards,
yeah.
Far West.
Oh, Hudson Far West. Yes, yeah. Okay, Hudson Yards. Right.
Yeah, and it's got another year and a half to go. I believe.
Okay. Yeah. Wow, we can't wait to see what goes on there.
Yeah.
Our issue also has, in addition to your, I think, brilliant essay everyone should read, there's also a coverage of case studies of different renovations, new buildings all around the country, all different sizes and shapes, including the Alliance in Atlanta, which is sending them on the road for a whole season. But they're refurbishing the Woodruff Center. There's also a piece on the Yard at Chicago Shakespeare Theater, which is they're making flexible pillars that could sort of move their space around for their sort of outdoor. It's not going to be entirely soundproof, apparently, but there'll be some sound issues there. But it sounds like an amazing new space.
They may need to have like a little buffer zone of like no boats come in.
Right.
No,
you might hear some fog. You might hear some foghorns go by. I think just like we hear sirens in New York at the Yard. I don't know if you're familiar with that space.
Yep.
that they're doing. Yeah. Are you consulting on that one?
No.
Okay. All right. It's a competitor, right? Well, no, it's a lovely piece. It kind of like we had the idea to do something about theater architecture. I think it was on our mind because every July, August, we were doing something related to design. But I don't remember even how this piece came our way. I think you might have just mentioned you had one.
I tossed it over the transom. Yeah.
It kind of defined our thinking about this for this issue and about theater architecture. Because you also link it to this innovation, you know, institutionalization and then breaking out of that cycle is also a part of art making. It's not just buildings, right? So I recommend everyone read that. And you come back with us after this interview to do some recommendations. I'll just set up the interview really quickly. Allison Friedman, Ping Pong Productions. We talked again. It's a kind of an exchange production company that brings Western artists and works performing arts to China. And vice versa, bring Chinese theater. I think she's in Berkeley now with a dance company, or at least when we spoke to her, she was. It's a fascinating story about cultural exchange and I think a hopeful one for this time. So enjoy. So I'm here with Allison Friedman, the executive director, artistic director, I don't know what your title is, of Ping Pong Productions, which is based in Beijing. And you program both tours for both Chinese companies to the rest of the world and bring American and other companies to China. Is that correct?
That's correct, yep.
And this is a sort of an extra chapter of our May-June issue on Chinese theater, a piece that we've tried to make happen in time for our deadline. And it didn't quite make it, but I'm glad that we can have this conversation because I'm fascinated by the work you've done. In fact, we're so fascinated. I think we've actually covered it over the years. I did a piece when LA Theater Works took the Pentagon Papers because great. LA Theater Works is a TCG member theater. And Susan talked to us about that, a little bit about that experience. It was the Times also wrote about it. And then, of course, our Tim Robbins interview was not explicitly about although we talked about the China trip. But the Midsummer Night's Dream was on our cover a couple years ago.
Right.
The photo might even have been from China. I'm not sure.
It was. Sure was. It was from the National Center for the Performing Arts when it premiered in Beijing.
So this is coming full circle in a way. Finally, we get to talk about the person behind some of these productions.
You got it.
So Allison, tell me a little about, you're based in Beijing. Tell me a little about how you got there and how Ping Pong started.
Absolutely. So I've actually been in Beijing for 15 years, and I went initially on a Fulbright fellowship to research modern dance in China. But my China story starts a little bit before that. My China story and my ping pong story starts a little bit before that. I had study the language. I was interested in languages. But at that time, it was still relatively rare that people were studying Chinese. And my classmates at Brown who were studying Chinese were mainly business and econ majors, you know, envisioning themselves on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange. And I thought, I like dance? What the hell am I doing learning Chinese? And I had done study abroad, but still felt like the foreigner in the foreign land, the stranger in the strange land, until the summer of 2001, when I was there interning at CNN, thinking I'd go maybe the journalism route. I thought, well, that's a little bit like performance. Hey, you're in front of a camera, you're combining disparate interests. And I met a dance company called the Living Dance Studio, and it was one of China's early dance theater collectives, artist collectives. They worked with a lot of visual artists who are really famous now, like Song Dong and documentary filmmaker Wu Wenguang. And we performed that summer in a piece called Dance with Farm Workers. They hired 30 migrant workers off of a construction site to work with them in the rehearsal process for a week. It was in a giant converted textile mill, this construction space that was being transformed into, you know, another high-end office building, gallery, mixed-use apartment complex. And keep in mind, this is 2001 when China had just received the Olympic bid. So the city was on, it was electric. It was just the energy and the feeling of possibility in China was alive. In the city of Beijing, especially, it was just alive. It was this feeling of we've arrived, the future is ours, we're all here. And so meeting that company blew it open for me that I could combine these schizophrenic halves of my life. I dance, performance, theater, and China. And it was also a liminal moment because until then, I really had loved being in China. I'd felt welcomed, had been interesting, but I did feel like a foreigner. I did feel very far away. But rehearsing with a Living Dance Studio, suddenly I found family. And as cliched as it sounds, we had the shared culture of modern dance. And it was this liminal moment of, oh, okay, you know, this is where these, the minute we stopped rehearsing, it got very formal and I was suddenly aware of my language barriers. But the minute we started rehearsing, I could have been in the studio at Brown and it was really familiar. So that was one of the seeds for Ping Pong. Way back in 2001. And then over the years, I worked with different arts organizations. I worked, you know, helped Tandun start his Shanghai office and worked with the Beijing Modern Dance Company. And what I realized, what I loved about all of these programs and projects wasn't just the great art, but how it bring cultures together. And it was, you know, all eyes on China for the Olympics. China was turning to the rest of the world. And what was missing from this sort of increasing rise of attention was sort of a more three-dimensional story. How do you show nuance and diversity and complexity and contradiction in these rich cultures? Well, the arts can do that. It's a little bit like the improvisation game, yes and, when, you know, that improv game. I like that framework because when you read, we're not in the business of saying, no, you're wrong. We're in the business of saying, well, yes, what you're reading in the newspaper is there. And there's so much else. And there's all this other stuff that you don't get to see. So that was the inspiration for starting Ping Pong, was how to tell the yes and story. And the arts can do that. The arts can be the bridge that shows sides of cultures and countries you don't get to see in the paper and through other routes.
So it sounds like, I mean, just knowing what Ping Pong does, from or like a little bit about what it does, is that's a two-way street. It sounds like you have a knowledge of Chinese culture that you want to share that's a fuller, more rounded view than we get in the West, and vice versa. I imagine the view of the West that is expressed in China is you want to show, as you say, what art can bring to that conversation, like the Western artists and theater companies and so on.
Precisely, absolutely. Yeah. And not just the West. I mean, the world is multilateral now.
Right,
I think
that's
the
true.
Other thing. It's like we're so
it's not
stuck
just East-West.
In that East-West binary, but we've got all of Asia and you know, China could learn as much about Thailand as they could about New York. So how do we kind of multi-polarize, or, you know, bring things out of the old binaries? Yeah,
that's interesting that I think you looked at the stories you ran about Chinese theater and some of the history of that. And, the thumbnail sketch we got of Chinese theater history, as we know, as spoken drama, was influenced a lot by Japanese culture, which is, of course, in turn influenced by. So there are regional influences within there that we tried to touch on. It's a big topic, obviously.
Right.
We'd covered Chinese topics before and Asian topics, but never
with a special themed issue. So,
nice. What inspired this particular one?
You know, it's a good question. We try to do a theme issue with every issue now, but every May, June, we always do a global one. And sometimes we've taken a theme like exchange or, translation as a theme to look at a lot of different global work. But a lot of times we'll just do a region. Last year we did Middle East, North Africa, which always seems to be, you know, always relevant. We did one on Canada. I wouldn't say we picked it randomly, but we were thinking about one place we think about, if we thought about actually was Russia. Russia and Russian theater and Deep went to the Golden Mask Festival this year, and I went a couple years ago.
Wow.
It's definitely in our thinking. There's some exchanges with theaters here that have and have not happened. But I felt like China was something that we should really turn our attention to and think about. As a theater culture, as Americans, we didn't know when we planned the issue where politics would be. You know, we knew. I think we already knew who our president was, but we weren't sure where. It was before the summit at Mar-a-Lago.
Okay.
But and you know, obviously we're at peace still with China. But in any case. No, we thought it was a large topic, and actually, you know, we'd had some contact with Stan Lai, who is already sort of a one man exchange program, you know,
totally.
Between Taiwan and mainland China, as well as the U.S.
Right,
but that's enough about what our decision was. I want to hear more about, you know, the one of the things I was most interested in. Let's talk about a lot of things, but the disgrace tour you just did.
Yes.
The tour of Ayad Akhtar's play, which you toured in readings, essentially. That's kind of the model used for Pentagon Papers, too, isn't it?
Actually,
to colleges?
You know,
no. Okay.
It's interesting. We started. You never make it simple for yourself.
Okay.
the initial idea was, yeah, let's keep it simple. Let's just do readings, and then of course, I mean, Timothy Douglas, who's such a brilliant director, just intuitively knew that Stan, you know, to really bring it alive for audiences, it was going to have to be more than a staged reading. So really, it was a production, and it was just a low tech production. So everybody was off book. There were costumes. There were props. And then we had basic set pieces that some we brought with us sort of donkey cart style in a suitcase. And then some we had each venue source locally. So it ended up being this really beautiful pared down. In Chinese, we called it jianhuaban of the pared down production.
And a tour to colleges and can you tell?
And
universities. I don't want to get too much into the weeds of it, but one model seems to be just trying to compare it to the U.S., is that for a lot of these productions go through universities. Some of the productions that our writers wrote about that they most looked to were ones that were at universities. And I wonder if is that comparable to our sort of universities that have relationships with theaters in the U.S., or is it something else?
Totally different.
Okay.
When we think of theaters in universities in the U.S., we think of some of our best presenters these university presenters across the U.S. Nothing like that in China. They have theaters, but a lot of them are more lecture halls. A lot of them are used for student productions or not used at all, frankly.
Right.
And so you don't have curators, presenters, professional touring networks through universities. Now, you do have very robust student productions that will use these venues, and I think that was some of the productions that were talked about in the issue. And then the reason that we choose to work there is because it helps us fulfill our mission of showing sides of countries and cultures and really having discussions about what's going on. And that was with Disgraced why we chose to do it that way, as opposed to, say, with Tim Robbins, where we brought him to major venues, major festivals, and it was, you know, tickets were sold, and we did do post-performance discussions with Tim and the gang as well, but that was with the audience who came to see the show. With Disgraced, because that production is so provocative and there's so many layers and it's so complex, when we chose that particular production, because it touches on so many relevant issues, we also wanted to really get into the weeds of the issues, and we didn't want to just kind of throw it at an audience and say, all right, goodbye and good night, you know, hope you had fun. So we translated the script. A lot of the schools read the play beforehand and had discussions before they saw it, and some didn't. But then once we were in the venue, in the school after the production, the post-show talks often went as long as 2 hours. So
really?
Even longer than the play
longer
itself.
Longer than play, wow.
Yeah, because there's a lot to unpack. And that was the purpose, is how do we start discussions? How do we use this as a jumping off point?
I know that a lot of theaters that have presented the play in the U.S., it was the most produced play a couple seasons ago.
Yeah.
And it's still very, very popular. Did do talkbacks, but I think there should be almost mandatory talkbacks after this show. I wonder, could you tell me how did it, just some logistics. Timothy Douglas is a U.S. director who we know is Chicago based or Seattle based. I can't remember.
New York now.
He was
in Chicago before. But now he's in New York. Mm-hmm.
And, was it an American cast or was it a Chinese cast?
Yep. It was an American cast.
Okay.
So it all started, actually, my Chinese colleague had seen the play when she was in New York.
Okay.
And it just ripped her open. I mean, she thought it was so powerful and she was so shaken by it. So she brought it to one of our production meetings and programming meetings about almost 2 years ago now, saying, I think this is something we should bring to China. So when our first step was to talk to the playwright and his agency, and to first, initially we were hoping they would be able to come to do discussions with us, mm-hmm. Scheduling wise, that didn't work out. But their recommendation, was to start with Timothy Douglas as the director, and then Timothy cast the show. So we had discussions early on about, do we bring in a director and rehearse it with a Chinese cast, which obviously works with a lot of different productions. With this particular play that is so much about identity and so much about race and religion and how you look in America, it you have to have the cast American and looking like, the roles that they're presenting. That's part of the discussion. And so it was really important for us to have an American cast playing these roles. And then we had the surtitles, which is what you do with foreign groups that come and tour China in performing in different languages, whether it's from Israel or France or America. They'll have Chinese subtitles. And then, of course, that was the other reason for us to get the scripts into the audience's hands in advance, because it goes so quickly just seeing the surtitles. So we were hoping, the plan was that most of the audience had read the play in advance, so that then when they saw the surtitles, it was another reading.
So I guess the most important question is, how did it go? How did it go over there? How did Disgraced play in China?
It was incredible. There again, back to our yes and. Yes, we're reading in the paper that China is cracking down on Western thought in the universities. Yes, we're reading that things are getting more conservative. And we could have easily booked a 3-month tour. There was so much interest in this production. There, the schools and the universities that we were dealing with, I mean, we literally could have had 3 months. That's not an exaggeration. We had to turn away schools and projects because we had a month of time to make it all happen. And I think what was interesting, what resonated most with a lot of these venues and these audiences was the plays grappling with cultural identity and who gets to choose and what do you give up and the internal struggle and the struggle with outer forces of cultural identity really resonated with people. I think that's obviously a universal issue, but in a place like China that's so ancient and modernizing so quickly and has always had international influences, but even more so now than ever before, a lot of these young people, and we worked in a lot of schools where a lot of the students, the high school students, are trying to go abroad, especially to America for college, they were thinking, okay, how am I going to be perceived when I get to America? What will my issues be? And how do I preserve my authentic self in another context, and what even is, quote unquote, my authentic self, and how do I grapple with that issue? So it was really a personal reading about it that a lot of the audiences reacted to.
Interesting. So you were saying that we read headlines about China cracking down on Western ideas, but I also read headlines about China cracking down on Muslim populations. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about how that aspect, it sounds like there was a general identification, people were able to apply a different situation to their own, but specific, I wonder if you could talk at all about specifically because those are some of the themes that have been so thorny in the U.S., in U.S.
Absolutely.
Productions of this play, the Islam.
Yeah, absolutely. It came up a little bit in some of the conversations, and actually after one production in particular at Nanjing University, this young couple, they were so sweet. They'd gone out after the show and like pulled little flowers from the garden outside the theater and brought them in and said, you know, we had to bring this to you and to the director because they were Han Chinese. Han is the majority ethnicity in China. And they said, you know, because we grew up in Xinjiang, which is the far western province in China, where there are primarily Muslim populations. And he said, you know, growing up, I knew some Uyghur and some Muslim friends, but I found it really hard to talk to them because a lot of issues would often become quite thorny and quite volatile. So I thought it was better, let's just not ever talk about it and preserve a nice surface friendship. Well, after tonight's play, I feel like I can't do that anymore and I have to have the hard conversations. And it's okay if people get upset, because that's what we have to do in order to really talk. And he was this quiet little guy, and his girlfriend was holding onto his arm. So I think with the play, you know, the play is quite provocative, but that was one example of somebody who came up to me to just say, oh, like, this is here in my backyard, and I have to have these conversations, even though it's really hard.
Wow, that's powerful. I wanted to ask more generally, not to pull away too much from disgrace, but you said when you first got there, around the time the Olympic bid was in, there was a real sense of excitement and probably even hopefulness. Do you feel like in the 15 years you've been there that the trend has been upward, or has things gotten more complicated, or how do you feel about the place you live now?
I think it's a sine wave, like okay. A lot of things. It's been up and down. I think the biggest rise was up to the Olympics, and the climax was really 2008, 2009, 2010, where there's still that hopefulness. The cleanup of the pollution for 2008 was at its peak around right. that time. The economy was still really doing well. There have been peaks and valleys since then. I think that the insane rate of change brings some people a lot of hope. It brings a lot of pressure with it. I think young people especially feel tremendous pressure, either that they should be a billionaire tomorrow, or that they have to, you know, if they're from another strata, there's still this pressure to take care of your parents if they're back in a village. So if you've migrated to a city, you're sending money back, and it's not easy. The city's cost of living is getting much higher. So the despair, the way, you know, the haves and have-nots disparity is continuing to increase, which obviously creates other kinds of pressures. So I think I feel that it's certainly not as optimistic and hopeful as it was around 2008, 2009. That doesn't mean it's not there. I think it's more tinted with anxiety.
Right. I read a piece that you wrote about, which we'll link to in this post, about that the changes in China, particularly around the market economy, has created, you know, more challenges to the arts there than even the Western perception probably is, oh, government censorship, you know. And could you talk a little bit about that, about the changes that we touched on this theme in some of the stories that we mm-hmm. had, that the frame, of course, at TCG for us is like the nonprofit versus the commercial theater, which is, it's just a totally different system and system in China, right? There's not,
right.
There's different sectors, but they're not easily defined as there's nonprofit versus commercial. There's state, right? There's state, state supported, and you
exactly.
tell me about
yeah.
that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Sort of Chinese arts funding history in a 2 second nutshell.
Right.
Is you know, once upon a time in recent history, everything was state run. It wasn't just the shoe factories or the coal mines. It was the performance troupes as well and the venues that they had. So as China was moving from that planned to a market economy, they weren't just shutting down or transforming those shoe factories and those coal mines. They were also trying to marketize or privatize different performing arts entities. And so with that came, you know, growing pains. The transition period, you sort of lose some things in the cracks in that transition period. So whereas in the US, which has obviously a much more developed system, nonprofit has number of fund streams. And of course, the grass is always greener. But in the U.S., we've got foundations, we've got you know, a tiny little bit of government funding. And then we've got this robust philanthropic and sponsorship system that encourages those kinds of income streams, as well as the earned income from ticket sales or parking or, you know, rentals for coffee shops. Now, in China, as they started to reduce the government funding, they basically, around 2006, with the 11th five-year plan, was one of the big shifts in trying to privatize and marketize these government troops. And they basically said, get thee to the marketplace, without there being a marketplace to get thee
right,
to.
Right.
So what that did was it made venues especially overly reliant on ticket sales, on earned income, as pretty much the only replacement of government funding. So what that does, if you don't have diverse income streams, is it makes venues very risk averse.
Right,
if you're
not
going to be a headliner to fill the box office, I'm not going to program you.
Yeah,
and then
yeah.
you've got this vicious cycle of how do you build an audience if you're not presenting these new things to develop the audience. So
Right. That's
something we don't. I mean, the grass. I don't say that the grass looks greener in that model, but it's
no.
You have your own challenges in everyone. Speaking of which, I just have a few more questions. And one is the business model of the ping pong. Is it a commercial venture? Is it supported by Chinese Ministry of Culture or is it U.S. money? A little bit about that.
Sure. So Ping Pong Productions in the U.S. we're a registered 501c3 nonprofit.
Okay.
We have a board of directors. We apply for grants, the usual foundations, corporations, individual for our American nonprofit. In China, there isn't really a nonprofit category for arts and culture. Again, with this transitional phase that the systems are going through. So our Chinese entity is a cultural exchange. Basically, it's called a WFOE, a wholly foreign-owned enterprise. So it means it's a Chinese-registered legal entity, but owned by a foreigner, which would be me.
Right.
And that's basically an LLC model. So our Chinese entity is a cultural exchange LLC, and then our American model is a nonprofit, but it operates. It operates as one brand.
So essentially, but you get most of your money raising money in the U.S. Is that?
No, it's really a mix.
It's a mix.
Yeah,
okay.
it's a mix. It really depends. We do get a lot of grants from really everywhere. We've received grants, certainly from the State Department and the U.S. Embassy in Beijing for projects like Disgrace. But we also get grants from the Ministry of Culture in China and the local Beijing municipality, you know, different city municipal bureaus of culture. We work a lot with Australia, so we've received grants from Australia's arts councils for projects bringing Australian artists to China. When we bring Chinese groups to France or Hong Kong and other regions, then certainly there's often funding from there. So it's a real mix of where our funding comes from.
So I just have two quick final things. One is the question I think a lot of people want to ask when they think about the arts in China or expression in China. Is this question of, you know, I know that one thing that actors get, another show that Actors Gang was touring a couple of years ago was a production of 1984.
Mm.
But obviously, I mean, not obviously, but can you tell me, do you think that would be a harder sell in China? If maybe that specific thing, or do you feel like there's basically limitations or constraints on what you can present there?
1984 specifically, I think, would be a challenge. Although the book is published in China in Chinese, it's available.
Sure. Yeah.
Ben Productions, although I'm not familiar specifically with that particular play. And then on the other side, even though it's more complex than the sort of big brother is watching in China, and I do want to complicate the issue of censorship perceived in the West.
Totally.
And there are realities of things that, you know, are a little bit challenging. Now, there are three explicit laws on the books about what's not allowed on stage. Nudity is not allowed.
Okay.
Self-mutilation is not allowed. And explicit criticism of the Communist Party or the government is not allowed.
Right.
Everything else is gray area and subject to interpretation. So, you know, as you guys know, the tour of the Pentagon Papers in 2011 and 2013, which is all about freedom of the press, independent judiciary, all of that. We got permits. You know, we got the Ministry of Culture gave us all the performance permits. It was completely, you know, it was the first American theater company ever to perform at the National Center for the Performing Arts in Beijing. It was very much above board. Now, that was also very much about America. So I think if we had brought a play that was kind of pointing fingers at China, it would have been a harder process.
I do know that it was reported in the Times, of course, that there was a talkback that was canceled at the last minute. I guess probably because, I mean, the perception was that, I guess the fear was the audience might make the connection and go, wait, you know, what about freedom of the press here? And that kind of thing, right?
I would assume so, exactly. Yeah. And it was canceled by, you know, a mid-level bureaucrat covering her own security at a university, which, sure, you know, sure. How many universities do we know that has some mid-level bureaucrat canceling something to protect their job security? So,
And I only ask the question because I think it's the one that comes to mind. I don't think.
Absolutely.
I think it's a glass houses kind of thing. I mean, we've. Mm. It's easy for us to say, oh, we can say anything here. I don't know. I don't know if that's really true. Yeah. The last thing that might be a related question is just, I know that this is kind of what your entire work is about, but if you could tell me, if people ask you, what's the thing you'd most, the misunderstanding you'd most like to set right about the culture that you present.
It's just more complicated than you think it is. Okay. Or not complicated, because that complicated often sounds negative, right?
Sure, sure.
I want if one thing, the hardest thing for us to keep in our minds is there, no, here's what I would want.
Okay.
There's more to the story.
Right.
There's always more to the story. So yeah, I think that's what I would like.
There's more to the story, and a lot of the things you present are those other stories, right?
Exactly.
The more stories. And you're in San Francisco now. Tell me what you're presenting there.
We've brought rising star Chinese choreographer Gu Jiani to San Francisco, and then we're off to Seattle, L.A., and New York.
And then you'll be back to Beijing at some point,
I imagine. And then back to Beijing, exactly.
Well, I hope we cross paths again in person sometime in New York, Allison. It's a total pleasure to talk to you, and I'm glad we could get this into our content somehow if it wasn't in the actual May-June issue. It's also not our last word on international theater and Chinese theater, so I hope we can talk again in the future.
Absolutely. Thank you guys so much for having me.
Total pleasure. And we're back with some recommendations, things to think about, things to see. Deep, what do you have?
I'm going to recommend a YouTube series,
okay,
or a YouTube person, I guess. His okay. name is Randy Rainbow,
okay,
and he loves musical theater and politics.
Wow.
And he does these YouTube videos where he splices himself like faux interviewing like political figures from recent news headlines, and then he will do a song that's like a parody of a musical theater song, but talking about like current political events.
Wow.
So like a recent one was he was interviewing in quotes Donald Trump talking about Russia, and he sang a song called The Russia Connection based on the Rainbow Connection.
Oh my god. Wow.
And my personal favorite was he did a medley of Covfefe.
Right. Is that how you pronounce it? Covfefe? Okay.
Well, one of the songs was like, you say Covfefe and I say Covfefe and let's call the whole thing off. It's amazing. I'm going to try and put the YouTube video into this episode because I think it's very entertaining. And also, I love this whole intersection of politics and theater. And sometimes you just, with all the horrible things happening right now, you just need something to make you laugh.
I think you're right. That's a fun one. I'll have to check that one out. Josh?
After DCGA, I went down to OSF.
Right.
Oregon
Shakespeare Festival.
Festival.
Most magical place on earth.
It is. Yeah. It is magical. And they do an incredibly wide range of kinds of work.
That's true.
And they do it really, really well. I mentioned Shauna Cooper's Julius Caesar earlier, which very, very well done. They've also remounted a Mary Zimmerman production of The Odyssey.
Oh, okay.
Which
yeah.
was breathtaking.
Wow.
Absolutely breathtaking and really well suited to their outdoor space.
Oh, wow. That's just, yeah, I wish I could see that.
Absolutely magical.
Wow. Yeah, that's always an interesting season there. I'm going to recommend briefly, when I was in Portland, I reconnected with an old friend, I don't know, colleague, Jessica Wallenfels, who's a director choreographer based in Portland, with Many Hats Productions is her production company there. And, she just wrote a piece for HowlRound, Can Rock Tell a Story or something like that? I actually don't remember the title exactly.
It's on HowlRound. I should look it up. It's Jessica Wallenfels. And I'm recommending it not just because she quotes me in the story, but she does pick us up on threads that about the intersection of rock and theater for myself and also Dave Malloy, who wrote a piece in for HowlRound years ago, A Slushy in the Face or something like that, about musical theater and rock.
And you really like interviewing Dave Malloy.
Oh, yeah, there's that too. Well, this isn't about my interviews with Dave Malloy, but one of the reasons I like that we're sort of on a similar wavelength is talking about, as a fan of rock and roll and a fan of musical theater, the ways that they do and don't mix is just a constant sort of, you know, burr in the saddle or whatever you want, like a bee in my bonnet, that like I want to see it work so much. And it works more and more. It's interesting. The big piece I wrote for American Theater in 2013 was years before Hamilton, as was Malloy's piece in 2011 or something. She picks up a lot of threads as a director choreographer herself, where she talks about why the musicals have that kind of form, and realizing, having done a lot of them, there's a reason why they don't rock and why rock doesn't work as well. And one of her recommendations or observations really is architecture plays into this, that the architecture of the space, there's a reason why Great Comet has to blow out the space everywhere they go, because it not that that's just a rock musical, but it's got new sounds in there, a new way of telling the story. The other one, Hadestown. I feel like if you look at the way that, or Hedwig being in a club, I think new ways of doing a space, or maybe not that new. I'm looking at someone who's knows all the spaces that have ever been done, but different ways to reorient us and to hear and feel the theater in a different way. Anyway, it's an interesting rumination from somebody who's been like trying to deal with it on her feet, literally, and make it work.
But it's not just a rock thing, right? I mean, people have been staging
she talks
traditional
about
musicals in non-traditional ways.
Yeah, well, exactly. Yeah. Well, she's trying to, and she's learning from both that form and also classical, having done dance, and just the challenges of making music and time and space all work to tell a story, you know? And,
well, the thing about rock is, like, you really can't sit and watch a rock show. Like, you experience a rock show. And so, like, for those things like
I think a lot of baby boomers sit and watch the rock shows now. Oh, but no, we stand too. I'm not a baby boomer myself, but I feel like one now. It's an open question. I mean, you know, music, a lot of music started as dance music, right? And became formalized. I mean, this could be a whole conversation about with what you talk about applies to music as well, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I certainly grew up with, in an era when punk came along and like to get those long jams out of the way and just short, fast, you know. And
didn't you used to have long hair too?
That was later. Oh boy, my past come back to haunt me. All right, we can cut all this, right? No. Anyway, Josh, thanks for coming in. Another
You're
fun
welcome.
Session. Deep. What do we say at the end of the show? There'll be links to all this. You can subscribe. Please subscribe.
Rate us on iTunes. Tell people about us. If you don't like us, don't say anything. things that we talked about will be on americantheater.org.
Indeed. Take care.
You say kofifi, and I say kofefe. You say kafefi, and I say kafife. Kofifi, kofefe, kafefe, kafife. Let's call the whole thing off. You say kofifi, and I say kofefi. You say kofif, and I say kafefi. Kafafe, kafefe, a cafe con leche. Let's call the whole thing off.